Hi, my name is Elma Baker. I wrote the book, The New York Regional Mormon Singles Halloween Dance, which is a memoir. And today I'm going to be reading just a short section from that book. First off, I grew up Mormon, and I lived in New York City for 10 years as a practicing Mormon. As a Mormon, living in the city trying to date, I had very short relationships. In fact, the longest relationship I was able to sustain because I didn't believe in having sex before marriage was 4 weeks. And that's only because for 2 of those weeks, the guy was out of town. So I didn't date very much until at the age of 23, I fell in love for the first time with an atheist. So this is a section from the book that sort of takes place in towards the end of the relationship as we're trying to make things work in spite of our differences. We went to the new Star Wars movie the following Tuesday. I was determined to ignore everything we'd been arguing about and just go back to the beginning. We will not discuss religion. We will not discuss sex. We will only have fun, I decided. It seemed like it was working, too. I wore a cute outfit and matching heels, and for a minute I felt like the girl again. The girl on the date. Until our walk to the subway. What do you think about cloning? Matt asked. I don't think about it, I said, unless I happen to see a movie about it, but in general, it doesn't come up. But doesn't it make you question your faith? Why? They haven't figured out how to do it yet. They've cloned sheep. So? It's a sheep, it's not a human. Yes, but they're very close to successfully cloning humans, he said. That's impossible. They can clone a sheep and it can move its eyes and walk and act alive. But they will never be able to successfully clone a human being. Why not? Scientists can't create that thing that makes us alive, I said earnestly. They can't create a person's soul. I don't believe in souls. What? I stopped in the middle of the sidewalk, breaking the flow. Several annoyed pedestrians bumped into me. What? I repeated. You don't believe people have souls? No. How is that even possible? I thought everyone, regardless of religion, believed in souls. I don't, he shrugged like it was no big deal. So, what makes you you? I asked. All the things that have happened to me, he answered. But when you die, what'll leave your body? Nothing. My heart will just stop beating. Are you being serious? I said, reevaluating everything I come to believe that Matt believed. It was too much. If I tried really, really hard, I could accept the notion that there wasn't a God and that maybe, just maybe, we'd ended up on Earth by chance. I could even accept that death was it, the end. But I couldn't possibly believe that there was nothing inside of me. Yes, he answered. I put my hand on Matt's shoulders and held him in place. People were still pushing by us, glaring or grunting passively aggressively, because we were both blocking the sidewalk. But I didn't care. I held on to him until it felt like there was no one left on the street but us. I stared deeply into his eyes without speaking. I looked into the hazel. I looked past the yellow specks. And I searched until I found the him inside of him. What are you doing? He finally said. I am looking at your soul. Matt, I can see it. I know that it is there. It speaks to me. He tried not to laugh. And what does it say? Screw you, I shouted. Only the expletive version of that. If Matt looked surprised, it was nothing compared to my face. It's not a word I use that often, but when making a religious point, it was the only thing that came to mind. Screw you, I repeated, still channeling his soul. I've been living inside of you for 29 years, and you've been ignoring me the entire time. My soul sounds kind of angry, Matt laughed. Tell me about it, I sighed. I think it feels neglected. We reached the subway station and said goodnight. Matt was halfway down the steps when he stopped and looked back up at me. Just so you know, he shouted, they're very close to cloning a human being. If they clone a human being, I shouted back, a fully functional, emoting, thinking human, I will have sex with you that very day. Several people stopped what they were doing and stared at me. One woman covered her son's ears. Matt jogged back up the steps. "Deal," he said. "Deal." We shook on it. "I'm going to read Popular Science every morning now," he said, walking back down the steps. "I am too," I called after him. For my own sake, I wanted it to be possible. I wanted scientists to clone a person and announce it on the morning news. Not for genetics or scientific progress, but because if a soul was something that could be obtained in a petri dish, it would nullify my definition of God, and I could sleep with Matt guilt-free.
Elna Baker is the author of the memoir, The New York Regional Mormon Singles Halloween Dance. She lives in New York City.
Who will save your soul when it comes to the bellies now? Oh, oh, we'll save your souls for those lies that you tell, boy. And who will save your soul if it won't stay alone?
So does the soul still matter in the age of science? Absolutely, says Parker Palmer, though he thinks the word itself often trips us up. Palmer is a writer and educator, and the author of a number of books, including Teaching with Heart and Soul.
Experientially, there are things in my life that can only be understood through the metaphorical window of this word soul. Different people name this in 1,000 different ways. You know, the Hasidic Jews talk about the spark of the divine in every human being. Quakers talk about the inner light or the inner teacher. Thomas Merton called it true self. Secular humanists, I think, call it identity and integrity. Buddhists call it big self or no self. But it seems to me that what you name it doesn't matter, but that you name it matters considerably, because my fear is that if we don't include this element or something like it in our conception of the person, of what it means to be human, then people end up being machines, objects to be manipulated. Something unfortunate happens in history when we don't have an appreciation of the essential quality of humanness, whatever you want to call it.
Listening to you talk about this, it is very clear that this word has a personal resonance for you in your life.
It does.
Discovery of soul has mattered.
Yeah, it has. And I can tell probably the seminal story of what that discovery was like. I have 3 times in my adult life suffered from clinical depression. And what's struck me about those 3 long journeys in the darkness is that all of the faculties one normally depends on, or I normally depend on, fall away. The intellect, for example, which in my case I depend on a lot, is useless in depression. Depression is not something you can think your way out of or think your way through. In fact, overthinking probably tends to drive people deeper into depression. The emotions, another faculty that we depend upon, are gone when you're in depression. Depression is not a feeling of sadness. It's the terrifying knowledge that you can't feel anything at all. The ego doesn't help. Another faculty that we need, I think, to get. I'm not an anti-ego guy. If you're going to do heavy lifting and hard work and sometimes even find it in yourself to be courageous, you need an ego. You need a strong sense of self. In depression, the ego is shattered. Your sense of identity is gone. And the will, the 4th function I would name, is barely functional. So in that darkness, every now and then, I would glimpse what I came to think of as the wild animal way back in the thickets in the woods, that kind of wild, primitive, original source that was somehow calling me to live rather than die, which is an existential question when you're in that place. And I came to think of this as the soul, and I did in fact come to think of it metaphorically as a wild animal in 2 senses. One is that a wild animal is very tough, very resourceful, very resilient. It knows how to survive in places where there's very little food, And at the same time, it's very, very shy. In fact, I don't think the soul even likes to be talked about much, so I talk with you about this at some risk. You don't get at the soul by shouting at it from a pulpit.
Part of what's interesting about it, though, to me, is that if you have a general discussion with a religious person about the soul, it is likely to be a much warmer and fuzzier contemplation that you assign the word soul to. The essence that you're talking about, there may be something warm and fuzzy about it, but I don't think that's what it is.
No, For me, I don't see it as warm and fuzzy at all. One of the things that I think you would find in common among many people who've been depressed and have lived to tell the tale is that they will say, having been there and survived it, what could ever scare me again? What could I ever find daunting again? And I think that kind of affirmation has an awful lot to do with discovering the soul and discovering this place in yourself that can be accessed only through deep quietude. You see, this is another reason why I think we don't know much about the soul. We live in a society that is noisy, is filled with energetic ego and active intellect, all things that I like. But when you live in a culture that resists solitude and silence, that resists introspection, you're very unlikely to ever get a glimpse of that wild animal. It would be like walking into a forest and shouting for the fox to come out. And you know that under those circumstances, that's when the fox is least likely to put in an appearance.
What does this mean, do you think, in the way you look at the contemplation of the soul and the way science does? You clearly don't have anything against the scientific pursuit of understanding who and what we are.
Science fascinates me, and I want to know everything that scientists know about the way the world works, whether that's the interior world of the human self or the cosmos. And in fact, I see an enormous overlap between the doing of science and engaging in contemplation. I don't know of a great scientist who hasn't said something about a contemplative dimension to his or her work.
For a lot of people, the assumption is easy that science can explain everything these days. It appears that you're saying there are still things that scientists recognize as beyond scientific method.
You're absolutely right. And I would say that any scientist who says our methodology covers everything is a fundamentalist, just as are people who claim that their particular version of Holy Writ explains everything. I think one important thing to be said here is that while science, with its commitment to what they call objectivity, has certainly advanced civilization by saving us from the subjective whims of princes and potentates and people of power who, for example, would declare millions of women over the course of history to be witches, it's also true that the rise of science has, to make a big leap here, but which I believe I can explain, has also supported the rise of authoritarian regimes, because it makes people dependent on experts. And it's not a big leap from saying, oh, science is the new religion. There are experts who know things that I don't. And so if scientific claims then get made to mask the manipulations of power, people are going to fall into line with that if they don't trust or have a well-developed sense of legitimate subjectivity. You don't have to look far for that. Look at what happened to our economy over the last decade. We listened to long lines of experts telling us how every day in every way we were getting richer and richer. And they weren't right.
Parker Palmer is an author and educator and founder of the Center for Courage and Renewal.
So is the essence. The essence from within. Soul is where everything begins.
Up next, a Christian theologian who says we should forget about the soul. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Does the Soul Still Matter? Is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, is supported by grants from the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions, by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and by the Neuer Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.